Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The disaster in Pakistan not only persists, but worsens, and the worst is yet to come. As floodwaters eventually recede, disease and starvation will follow. What is the world doing to help, and what can it do? And how do the politics of the region play into the relief effort? Joining us later on will be a CARE International spokesperson who is in Pakistan and also an ActionAid worker, communications manager. ActionAid is an international coalition fighting poverty across the globe and working there right now during the crisis. Joining us now, we welcome back McClatchy Newspaper's senior correspondent, Jonathan Landay. His colleague, Saeed Shah, is on the ground in Pakistan, and Jonathan has been reporting from Washington on the crisis with Saeed. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Pakistan was struggling economically before the flooding. Food supplies were insecure before the flooding started. What now?
Well, at the moment, there are estimates of crop damage of around $1 billion. But, you know, that figure is absolutely certain to increase. You have about, I think it's somewhere around 20% of the country's landmass now affected by these floods. And as you said earlier, food insecurity in Pakistan was already a serious, serious problem before the floods hit. In fact, World Food Program data from 2008 shows that about 77 million Pakistanis, that's almost half of the country's population, were going hungry in that year because of increases, wild increases in food prices in Pakistan and food shortages, and that the number of people who are malnourished, is also quite high. And so, as you pointed out, the worst may well yet be to come in Pakistan. The death toll right now around 1,600, which is actually it's a tragic figure, but it's small for natural disasters in Asia in recent years. But as a lot of people expect, the situation in Pakistan will worsen as disease spreads, as hunger spreads, as the country tries to grapple with the massive economic costs of this disaster.
Britain's International Development Secretary Andrew Mitchell says the international response to the floods so far has been very slow. Let's listen.
Well, I think aid is now getting through. All the evidence is that after a desperately slow start and a woefully inadequate response from the international community, aid is now arriving. And one of the things you see here is the resilience of the people who, faced with this disaster, want to get on and rebuild their lives. And that underlines the absolutely critical importance of the international community giving them the tools so that they can start to rebuild all that has been destroyed in the last few days.
Jonathan, Secretary Mitchell said response slow. Has it picked up?
It is going to pick up. There is a UN General Assembly session today in New York to consider the appeal from the UN for about $459 million in assistance. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is going to go to represent the United States, and she is expected to announce that the United States would increase its aid, which right now is pledged at about $99 million, I believe, that figure will go up to about $150 million. And today, there have been other countries that have announced additional aid increases and additional help, like helicopters and that kind of thing. But again, this is immediate short-term assistance. The country is going to need a huge amount of aid in the future. It is already living off a line of credit, I believe, from the International Monetary Fund of I think it's around $400 million. They've just took out another loan from the World Bank of $900 million, which had originally been intended for economic development projects that are very, very badly needed in Pakistan. And Pakistan's debt now, its international debt, stands in excess of $50 billion. And one needs to look at this on a micro level, the level of the people who have been affected. For the most part, they're farmers who have had very low yields of crops in recent years and have had to go out in debt to plant the new crops. A lot of them are what we here in this country know as sharecroppers. These are particularly the farmers in southern Sindh province. It's a very feudal society there, where you have very wealthy landowners owning huge amounts of property that goes for the family of the assassinated Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, the very major landlord in landowning family in southern Sindh. And the farmers who farm that land are in debt to the landlords. They have to pay the landlords for the land that they use to grow their crops on. And these people are already in a desperate situation. Now they don't. Their farms have been destroyed. Their crops, the major crop down there, one of the major crops, the most profitable, is sugarcane. That was already was supposed to be harvested, I believe, in September, October. That's all underwater. So the magnitude of this disaster, it's huge, but the fears are that it's only going to get worse.
Mark Malik Brown, he's a former Deputy Secretary General of the UN. He criticized the country's leaders for failing to make the scope of the destruction and the urgency of the need to clear international donors.
Absolutely. I mean, the way that this government has handled this disaster. I mean, you had the president of the country, the spouse of the late Benazir Bhutto, President Ali Asif Ali Zardari, going off on a high rolling visit to Europe, to France, and to Britain at the beginning of this flood, so that he could in part preside over the political coming out of his eldest son at a massive rally in Birmingham, England, during which a member of the audience threw a shoe at the president. He is vastly unpopular now, but the government itself, which is woefully inadequate in terms of providing services in ordinary times in Pakistan, the government itself admitted days and days ago that it is overwhelmed, that it has been unable to cope with the scale of this destruction. Now, granted, any government would find it very difficult to cope with the scale of the destruction. But in Pakistan, you have a government, as I said, that has been terrible in terms of delivering ordinary services to its people. It's a system that favors the wealthy. The very small percentage of wealthy in Pakistan live extremely rich lives, massive houses and cars, and they pay very, very few taxes. In fact, the country is one of the lowest tax collection countries in the world. There are laws that allow the Pakistani elite to take their money out of the country and then bring it back into the country without any scrutiny from the authorities, and therefore very few of the elite pay any taxes.
Is a military coup possible? I think it was in one of your reports. It might have been in the New York Times. If the flood proves to tilt the balance of power in Pakistan, it's more likely to tilt toward the militants than toward the government.
You're saying about what the chances for a military coup? Is that your question?
Yeah, the first, and then there's the militant issue as well.
Absolutely. Well, on the first issue, the fact is that the military in Pakistan, through four phases, has ruled the country for more than half of its history. And it just ended the last phase of military rule in 2008 when the current government was elected. No experts in either Pakistan or here in the United States are willing to rule out the possibility of a military coup, but they think at the moment it's very unlikely for a number of reasons. First of all, the military became vastly unpopular during the 8 years of rule by the former dictator Pervez Musharraf. The new Army Chief of Staff, General Ashfaq Kayani, has made it a deliberate effort to remove the military from politics. And quite frankly, I don't think either he or his top generals want to take on the burden that this government, that their civilian counterparts now have, and then get blamed for failing to deliver, failing to alleviate the massive suffering. I think that the Pakistani military right now is far more content to be the heroes, actually, of the relief effort. The military is all over the place, still using its entire fleet of helicopters and transport planes to deliver food aid, to deliver, to rescue people. I mean, they've got members of the Pakistani Navy out in small rubber rafts. My colleague Saeed Shah went out into the floods with them last week to rescue people stranded by this deluge, and so the military is enjoying a bump up in its image. And at the moment, most experts I've talked to don't believe that the military wants, as I said earlier, to take on the massive burden and responsibility of having to a responsibility for flood for the blame for things that go wrong. They would prefer to enjoy the newfound status they have.
You know, it's different there, though. People separate the military from the government than we do here.
Absolutely, and that's because the military is a fiefdom unto itself. Mm-hmm. In fact, in Pakistan, the military right now, they kind of have this modus vivendi with the civilian government, and that is the military basically says, you stay out of national security policy making, you stay out of major foreign policy decision making, you leave that to us, and you can do everything else, but you will not interfere in national security affairs. We will continue running that show. And that is a modus vivendi that has, at least until now, worked. Your second question was about the threat of the
militants
mm-hmm. and the ongoing insurgency that has been plaguing Pakistan for, exploded in 2007 following an assault on a mosque that was being held by the militants in Islamabad under the former regime of General Musharraf, in which many people were killed, and that really triggered a massive surge in the insurgency, along with Pakistani and American attacks on militant bases in the tribal area bordering Afghanistan, in which many people were killed, many civilians have been killed, and that has also inflamed the Islamic insurrection. Now, the thing is, though, that a lot of the groups, some of the groups, particularly Islamic fundamentalist extremist groups based in Sindh province, southern Punjab province, in the south of Punjab, which is the largest province, who had been patronized by the military, trained to fight on the Indian side of the disputed Kashmir region, they have front organizations, charities, that have filled in the vacuum left by the government's failure to provide aid and relief in places that have been hit by the floods, and therefore they use these front organizations to build their own popularity, to build support among people for their own, for themselves, and to recruit. And there is definitely a concern among U.S. officials, among Pakistani officials, other Western officials, that these groups will exploit the situation in Pakistan to recruit and to build support for themselves as the government's popularity just dips to all-time lows.
The Pentagon has stepped up with 3 ships, 2,000 Marines, aircraft, relief supplies. Where is all that coming from? Is that coming from Afghanistan right now?
No, right now the task force that's off of the Pakistani coast in the Arabian Sea, I believe that came out of the Gulf. There is an amphibious assault vessel there and a couple of support ships, 19 helicopters, as you point out, 2,000 Marines, that they replaced an American vessel, which is the first major contribution from abroad. From foreign donors to the relief efforts. That was the Peleliu. It's now been replaced, and certainly this is part of an American effort, an Obama administration effort, to try and maintain what modicum of stability exists in Pakistan as a result of these floods and prevent a further drift of people towards the militants and at the same time to try and improve the image of the United States in Pakistan, despite the fact that the United States is the biggest aid donor to Pakistan. The fact is that the United States is terribly unpopular in Pakistan, blamed by many members of the elite and the media there for the insurgency in Pakistan and indeed in Afghanistan, which they see as the root cause of the insurgency in Pakistan. And in fact, is not the case. The fact is that Pakistan was patronizing the Taliban, was the major benefactor of the Taliban from their inception back in the early 1990s.
Jonathan, I have a few more questions, but we have to take a break, and I was wondering if you could stay on with us for a few more minutes when we return.
Yeah, no problem.
Excellent. Thank you. We're going to take a break right now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. And at 1 o'clock on point, we'll be here. The Atlantic Magazine's Jeffrey Goldberg says Israel is preparing right now to bomb Iran. On Point gets his report and a critique of bombing to stop the bomb in Iran. That discussion on Point at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories heard on WOSU comes from the law firm of Porter, Wright, Morris & Arthur, LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.
75 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:22 this morning, sunshine today and a high of 85, clear skies tonight, a low of 62, sunshine for Friday and a high of 88. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us, Jonathan Lande, senior correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Jonathan, thanks for staying with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
And also joining us now, Jazeera Malik. She is communications manager for ActionAid Pakistan. She's speaking to us from Pakistan. Welcome to the show, Jazeera.
Thank you so much, Anne. It's a pleasure.
Jonathan, I just had a couple more questions about the politics in the region. We've talked about it before, and I guess some folks are seeing it as a hopeful sign that officials said Pakistan and India are in close touch about the floodwaters, and they're talking about maybe working together to ease the problem?
Yes, in fact, India has offered a lot of aid. I believe it's somewhere in the region of $50 million. It's probably in kind. I may have that figure wrong. Mm-hmm. But, of course, these two countries are estranged. They are divided over the conflict, a dispute over the region known as Kashmir. Mm-hmm. They have been on the outs, especially since the attack, the terrorist attack in Mumbai that was tracked back to a Pakistani group that had been patronized by the Pakistani military. And it would be a huge gesture. I mean, India is the regional superpower. It's the economic giant. It's right next door. It has the capability of really being able to push in massive amounts of aid very quickly into Pakistan, and it would be a great thing if Pakistan would accept the Indian offer, because that aid could be expedited.
The flooding in the river, this has been expected for a long time because of how the river's been managed for the last 150 years.
In fact, it's my understanding that Pakistan has the world's largest, or at least one of the world's largest, man-made irrigation systems. But because of mismanagement and corruption that is endemic, even in agriculture, even in the agricultural section, mm-hmm. a sector of Pakistan, that this system loses up to 70% of the water that it usually that flows through it before it can be used to irrigate the crops, because it has been so badly allowed to deteriorate. And that system also is supposed to, I believe, channel excess water away from the main body of the Indus River. The Indus River, of course, is the river that courses through the center of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. It forms a valley down the center of Pakistan, and that is the river that has overflowed its banks to a massive, unprecedented extent.
In Pakistan, there is the shortage of the most basic supplies now. Shelter, food, and drinking water present the biggest challenge for aid workers. Jazeera Malik, what do you see there? What are people talking about now about what is needed now?
As I have visited some of the worst affected areas up in the northern valley of Swat and also in the southern parts of the country, Punjab province, that has been badly affected by flood, I've met some families who've lost everything, right from their homes to their possessions, their livestock, their agriculture. And the immediate needs include obviously food to start with, then they want clean water, they have to have essential medicines, and then there's also now the new problem that is surfacing is the management and coordination at the camps, because some of the camps that have been established by the government where people are seeking immediate shelter after being displaced from their homes, there are so many issues there, because we just finished an assessment visit in Sindh, which is now the target of this flood, people don't find food there. It's most of the time they're forced to eat rotten food. They're supposed to drink contaminated water, and then there are protection and security issues for women and children. So by talking to these people directly, we get a sense of disappointment and anger towards the slow response by government. And also this lack of coordination between various wings of the government, so people really don't know what's happening. There's a very bad information system. Early warning is given, but people are not communicated as to where they can go to seek shelter, what they can take with them, what they must leave behind. So, you know, very basic of information is lacking for the people.
How do they get around? It looks like everything's so washed away. The infrastructure is just gone.
You're so right. Because from my last visit to South Punjab, that was a week after the flooding had happened. And I could still see a number of families just huddling under plastic sheets and sitting on the sides of the road, just waiting for some transportation to take them to some relatives or friends, because they didn't know where else to go. They didn't have any money. So they were just, you know, waiting for some relief to get to them. And also there were people stranded on the cut-off areas on banks of the river. And a similar situation we saw in Swat because of washed-away bridges and roads. People were just stranded in their small villages with no supply of food, medicines, water, no access to any information, no access to any communication infrastructure, and obviously nothing reaching them. Because of continuing monsoons, the food that was initially being tossed down by helicopters had to be stopped because the weather didn't allow the helicopters to fly. So basically those people were just left on the mercy of the bad weather, continuing monsoons, and floods.
The people who are getting out, where are they going? I understand that the cities are going to be overflowing soon.
You're right in that, because because we have a strong community system here in the rural areas, especially.
Right.
So when people lose their homes and possessions, the first shelter they'd like to go to their relatives or friends. But then we should also take into account that most of the people affected were already very poor. So most of the relatives that they had were also very poor. That is the reason why we see many people still shelterless. The affected people who were lucky enough to find an immediate shelter either in a relief camp run by the government or by any aid agency, they're still suffering. But worst condition is with but the people who couldn't even find this immediate shelter are living in worst conditions because they don't have any shelter. They're still at the mercy of bad weather and also vulnerable to many different kinds of problems, which obviously includes security and protection. Again, I would reiterate the point that in any devastation, women and children are the worst affected. And issues are also emerging now that even in the camps that are managed by the government, the specific needs of children and women are not being fulfilled. Such basic necessities as toilets, or good hygienic conditions or privacy, even that is not being looked after. So it's really, really a terrible situation on ground.
Jonathan Landay, there are wealthy people in Pakistan. Is it a culture where they will help people less fortunate than them, or is it just completely government-oriented relief?
Actually, no. There are some incredibly wonderful charities in Pakistan that work all the time in terms of delivering aid, in terms of helping the vast number of Pakistanis who exist in poverty, and they very much are involved in the relief effort. Then you have Islamic charities, some of which, as I said earlier, yeah, are fronts. And I think that the wealthy do kick in funds, but certainly nothing close to the amounts that they could kick in. I mean, we're talking about, and this is a very small number of Pakistanis, but it is the elite,
right,
the political elite, own properties, you know, flats in Mayfair in London. I remember being in Karachi and being taken out to going to lunch at the home of a very wealthy businessman who served Scotch salmon that had been flown in from Scotland in special containers. Mm-hmm. And so the amount of wealth that exists in Pakistan is among a very small minority of Pakistanis is quite massive. And some of those people do give to relief efforts. But for the most part, I think that they could probably give a lot more.
We have a short email. It's from a listener. What organization can Americans give money to, and how can they be sure their money will be used to help the people? Jazeera, do you have an idea about that?
Yes, if you ask me, definitely I would say this is a time when individuals must come forward because, as Jonathan rightly said, there are rich people in Pakistan and probably they're giving also. But then again, it's such a vast and widespread devastation that the world hasn't experienced in the recent past. And this is a time when individuals from all across the world should step forward and try and help these poor people already suffering. Now, I can share with you, if you allow me. Obviously, I would request for people to come forward and contribute and donate to ActionAid. And if you allow me, I can share the web link. It's
We'll post that on our website already. We have it. So, Jazeera,
don't
worry about that.
And
but,
also, mm-hmm. when people are willing to donate, they must make sure, this is our individual responsibility also, to make sure that the money is going to be spent for the purpose for which it's being given.
Yeah.
And for that, it's important that people can have access to credible information. Some of the UN websites have information about the international organizations that are very much active on the ground. And instead of, this is just, some common things to remember. Instead of giving to someone you don't know, it's better to give to some organization or some institution that you know has worked in the past also. So, when we are giving some money, then obviously we need to be sure that it will be spent on the right for the right cause and for the right people.
And you ask a very the caller draws attention to, or your email draws mm-hmm. attention to the fact that the government in Pakistan has tried itself to raise money and it's not doing a very good job because nobody trusts that the money will find its way to the right places simply because the government is so infused with corruption. Let me also make a correct the amount of money that India is offering. It's offering $5 million, not $50
okay.
million dollars in aid.
Mm.
One other thing, obviously people should give to the charities of their choice. One of the biggest charities, one of the most effective charities in Pakistan that people can give to is the Eddie Foundation. It's quite an amazing foundation that run ambulance services and clinics, and they have a website that people can go to.
How's that spelled, Jonathan?
E-D-H-I. Eddie Foundation.
Okay. What are your expectations, Jazeera, right now about how many people could be lost from this? I know about 1,500, 12 or 1,500 are already dead. What are we looking at?
Well, actually, the official death toll as of yesterday was about 1,500. Obviously the government states that the total affected people, affected directly or indirectly, is about 20 million. But, you know, the long-term implications of this catastrophe have also to be remembered, because now most of the parts of the country that have been affected by these floods were the food-producing areas. And we are fearing that because people have lost that, their livestock and agricultural land, and also because standing crops and thousands and thousands of acres of standing crops have also been destroyed, this would have a very long-lasting effect on the food security. People would not have enough food to eat in the coming months and years. This is a very big challenge, and it's going to have a, definitely very long-lasting effect on the entire country. In terms of aid, I would agree with the discussion that was going on before this. The amount that's needed for relief, immediate relief only, has not been able to get as much. And yes, there are political and government issues. There are issues of image. People aren't really sure whether their money would be spent for the right purpose. But in addition to that, maybe the global economic crunch has also to play some part in this, mm-hmm. because there's just recently been Haiti earthquake, and people from all across the world and organizations and donors, they responded to that. Now, just, you know, barely we had sort of overcome that shock when the flooding began in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So it's, these some of the global factors that have also need to be taken into account.
Okay, I want to say thank you to Jazeera Malik, Communications Manager for Action Aid Pakistan. Thank you for joining us, Jazeera.
Thank you so very much.
And Jonathan Landay, thanks again for joining us as always. We always appreciate your help.
My pleasure.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a break now. When we return, we're going to meet a couple of documentary filmmakers from Belgium. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In just about a minute, we'll hear about the quest of two documentary filmmakers to find stories of towns named Amsterdam in North America. And then at 11 o'clock, stay with us for hour two of All Sides when Hair Theater creator Pat Wynn Brown talks about spreading laughter and raising spirits. That discussion begins at 11 on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 76 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Sunshine today and a high of 85 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 62. More sunshine for Friday and a warm day with a high of 88 degrees. And looking ahead to Saturday, there is a chance of rain and a high of 92. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who sings of the dreams that he brings from the wide open sea. In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who sleeps while the riverbank weeps to the old willow tree.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. John Denver, if you didn't recognize the voice. John Denver is singing a song about Amsterdam, and Amsterdam, Ohio is, I guess, kind of what we're talking about today. When's the last time you thought of Amsterdam, Ohio? Frankly, I never have thought of Amsterdam, Ohio before. Where is it anyway? We invited two documentary filmmakers into the studio today to find out who are out traveling to find the stories of Amsterdam around the world, including Ohio. They're here to tell us all about it. So welcome to the show, Rob Rombaut. And also Roger Van Eck, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
You are not Dutch. You're Belgian.
No, I am Dutch.
You
I
are
live
Dutch.
In Belgium.
Okay, gotcha. Why do you care about Amsterdam?
I'm born in Amsterdam.
Okay.
And I'm living in Belgium for over 25 years. And every day people remind me by my accent in French or even in Flemish that I'm from Holland. So as a filmmaker, and Roger, he's also Dutch originally.
Okay.
So we thought, well, let's make something about Amsterdam. And to make it more complicated, we found many places around the world, which made the whole project more attractive, of course. And it all started up 10 years ago when we were finding two small islands named Amsterdam, one near the North Pole and one in the middle of the Indian Ocean, a kind of an impossible place to go. But we went there, and it was a real adventure. It was a 1.5-hour film came out of it. And this film got quite some echoes in the United States. They kind of liked this idea. And then we looked at the map of the United States, and we found out that there were over 16 places named Amsterdam in the United States.
Or New Amsterdam,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Including New Amsterdam, New York. New York used
the
to
original,
be.
The original, right.
Yeah. So the interesting thing of it is that they're all spread out over the United States, and they make a kind of a line, which makes, of course, brought us to the idea of making a road movie from one to another, including the road in between. So it's not only the places, but it's also the traveling through. And we're doing that with our American crew, Ben Wolf, cinematographer, and Colin Bannon, who is the soundman and organizer. So we four of us with an American truck, we're traveling around.
The line that you talked about, is that trace the path of Dutch immigration across the country?
It follows mainly the flow of the Dutch immigration through the United States. All these places, when we made our research, we discovered also that most of these places, there are no Dutch anymore living there. It are other populations, other origins, Polish, Scandinavian, Germans. So the name, I suppose that these names were called Amsterdam by the immigrants because there was a canal or a water or a mill, and suddenly, or even it's by nostalgia, you know.
Yeah, I come from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where half the phone book still is in Dutch. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering about that, whether there actually are any Dutch in New Amsterdam. Tell us about Amsterdam, Ohio. Where is it and who lives there?
When we did our research on Amsterdam, Ohio, we had only one source, that was Google Earth. So we saw a crossroad, two roads, and we couldn't find anything about it, 900 people. And then we kept on searching, and we found a girl who was living there who's making a poetry book. She's in contact with all poets in the world. And so we had a contact with her, and we tried to find out who was living there. But we didn't have any imagination of how it should be. We knew there were some unemployment. There were some coal mines that were closed. But it's difficult to imagine it. We had an imagination of an old industrial, desolated place. And it was not all like that, not at all. People were very friendly. The environment is very nice. It's kind of a good place to live, unknown. And that's also one of the things we are looking for. We are looking for the unknown America. Unknown America not only for Europeans, mm-hmm. because in Europe we only know New York, the West Coast, East Coast. We don't know what's in between. We have a kind of a cliche idea what's in between.
Well, people in the United States have a cliche idea of what's in between.
That's what I think also.
The funny thing is what we, the imagination we have about America, and we discover something completely different. And that is part of the film, to confront what we thought about it and what we think about it, or the cliches we have about it. We have a lot. Through movies, through music, through books, etc., about America, and suddenly we discover a completely different reality and the real people. The real people from the middle America, from the unknown America, in fact. But America we rarely see in movies or about, we rarely speak in books.
But the funny thing is, even in those very, very small communities like Amsterdam, Ohio, we found out that there is Polish, German background, Ukraine. There are people that have fought in Vietnam, in Iraq. Everything is there, in a way. Also, there is only 900 people. And it's amazing for us to travel. We've been traveling through New York, New Amsterdam, Amsterdam upstate New York, Amsterdam in Pennsylvania. And this is a very small town. But we had so many stories to film. We've been running for 3-4 days that we said to each other, we said, the smaller the location is, the more stories there are. And that's a bit, the title of the film as well. It's named Amsterdam Stories USA. We're not only looking for the history, we're mostly looking for people that tell a story. And behind the story, we see, we feel something of the unknown America.
That's interesting. The more the smaller the town, the more stories there are to tell. Wonderful discovery, right? Amsterdam in the Netherlands, capital and largest city of the Netherlands, population 6.7 million in the metropolitan area. That's in 2008. Began as a small fishing village in the 12th century, and by the 17th century became a major world port. Probably not the case for Amsterdam, Ohio, but I wonder what you're discovering about the legacy of the Netherlands in the United States.
That is very interesting. We've been reading the book of Russell Shorto and about what's left of this Dutch presence. As you know, when there is a taking over or a war, the history is always written by those who won, who took over. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it's the British who wrote history of the United States in a way, and made them forget what was this Dutch presence, what took only 50 years. It's been very often said that those were pirates, those were whores, they were only there for the money. But there was some legal backgrounds, some written elements you can find later on in the formation of the United States. They took over some of the ideas. It's a little bit of forgotten history of what's left of this Dutch history.
Are you only traveling along that line of towns that you mentioned, or are you making some side trips to places where there are large populations of descendants?
We're making some small side walks because it's not a journalistic film. Mm-hmm. We are not looking for facts. We are looking for stories. And one of the funny stories that there is not only locations with the name Amsterdam, but also people. So we met a dentist.
Who knew?
There was a dentist named Robert Amsterdam. He's living upstate New York, a little bit on the road. So we did a dental check for Roger. And we found in Philadelphia, the head of mental diseases is a man called J. Amsterdam. And we have the idea, we didn't get him yet, but that he might interview us. So that makes a funny element of this film also. It's not only serious. There are some detours. And we might also have a thing I forgot to tell you, that one of the elements of this film is not only the small towns in America, but also the radio. Radio is a very important element of this trip because we've been on many radios along this trip. Mm-hmm. And the voice of the radio, especially the radio in America, is something really special. It has a very, very very specific soundtrack, a specific rhythm that we don't have in Europe. And the communities are very much related to the local radio. So that's also one of the detours we make.
You know, they said radio wouldn't survive television.
It's absolutely not true. They said the same thing about cinema wouldn't survive television. And cinema has to do with imagination. It has to do with what you suggest. And if you make radio, you see images. So it's absolutely not forgotten as a media.
How is the film financed? How are you financing it? Are you self-financing, or are there people that have invested?
We write a dossier, and we present it to a producer. In this case, it was a producer in Brussels, because we live in Brussels and we are known in Brussels as filmmakers. We are also known in Brussels because we are teachers both on film schools over there. And the producer will present it on the cultural board, the Belgian cultural board, the French-speaking Belgian cultural board, because we speak two languages in Belgium, Flemish and French.
Right.
And it is quite strange that we receive money on a project which is about a Dutch name from the French part of Belgium. But okay, that's the way it goes over there. and in fact, the producer raised money coming from this cultural board. We have also the aid from the Belgian television, the French-speaking television. And we hope to have more televisions in Holland, in France, and possibly also in America. We're perhaps in contact with PBS or something like that.
Okay. 614-292-8513. We have about 5 minutes. And Jeff, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. If your guests would like to add a little bit of interesting color, a little bit of the old world and the new, a visit to Bell Fountain would be good here in Ohio. On a map, if you read it to the unfamiliar, it looks like Bellefontaine, but in fact it's pronounced Bellefountain.
Everything's pronounced strangely in Ohio.
Yes. And there you will find the Holland Theater. And it is a classic 1920s movie house designed to look like a little Dutch village, including little wooden tulips, a windmill with vanes that turn, and a cloud machine that projects clouds on the ceiling with the lights sparkling to represent the sky at night. And it's definitely a wonderful place. It's owned by a nonprofit, and you should be able to get in there and get a little footage if you're looking for beyond just places called Amsterdam for other aspects of this imported heritage.
Yeah, that's just about 40 minutes from Columbus, right?
Yes, it is. Northwest up Route 33.
Highest point in Ohio as well, right?
Yes, you can go visit the 1,500-foot highest point in Ohio, too. Hold your breath.
Yeah. Don't get dizzy, right, Jeff?
Right.
All right. Thanks for your call. The Holland Theater in Bell Fountain. Take care.
It's worth a visit.
Okay. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, you can almost also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'd love to hear what you think about this. Jeff's comment kind of reminded me of you growing up in Grand Rapids. That's where Meyer stores are from, and it used to be called Meyer Thrifty Acres. And the marquees or whatever you call it would have a little Dutch boy with the wooden shoes kind of kicking in the air sort of a thing. And there's a lot of that sort of imagery about the Netherlands, about the Dutch. Do you want to tell people about the Dutch today?
No, it's true that when we made our research, a lot of cities of villages called Holland, New Holland, and other clones from European cities, mainly Dutch cities. And we are not looking for the clichés. Huh?
Right.
Because in these villages, they have all a mill, they have all wooden shoes. That is a Dutch cliché.
It tends to be more the clichés than in the places that are called, like Holland, Michigan, that kind of place.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. What would you say about Holland?
About Holland, it's a country with the highest density of population in the world, and that is a fact. That's not a cliche. After Bangladesh, and it is also a country that has 1/3 of the country is under sea level. Now this makes that people have to get on well. You can't live how you like, because everything is related to everything. Mm-hmm. Every square meter has a function, is organized. It's an over-organized country sometimes. Sometimes it's very nice to be Dutch. It's also sometimes very nice to live outside of Holland. as you understand what I mean. It's a little bit heavy sometimes. It's a country that has a Protestant background. I wouldn't say that whole Holland is Protestant, because it's only one-third. One-third is Catholic, one-third is non-believer. But the Protestant culture, which is something different, is still over there and still present. There's a huge difference between Holland and Belgium. It's only 2 hours away. People understand their language, but they don't understand their culture. Jokes are not the same. So it has, strange enough, it has a lot to do with this 500, 400 years ago separation of the church. The Dutchmen, they have this baseline. I don't know whether I can translate it in English. It means that you have to take care that your head never passes the level of the field. It means that you have to have low profile.
Okay.
Never make yourself too...
Low country is low profile.
Low profile. Never say too much. Never be too special, because you... we're all the same, and so on. So it's a very, I would say, that is more what the country, that's more the country than the image of the mills. The mills, they are there, mm-hmm. and they use it themselves for public relations also. But the Dutch, you know, they are very strong in public relations. They are capable of selling the worst beer to America and make it feel like it's something fantastic.
Well, Americans can sell the worst beer to America, so, you know, we are just about done. I want to say thanks, and I hope that you'll let us know if and when the film, when it's done, is showing anywhere near where an Ohioan...
We have 4 steps more of shooting in the U.S. till we reach California. So the film will be edited end of 2011. So it will go out in 2012.
All righty. And we'll have a website that we can post on our website, allsides@wosu.org. Or I'm sorry, wosu.org/allsides. We'll post the website to your operation on there. And I want to thank you, Roger Van Eck and Rob Rambout, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Filmmakers who are traveling the United States looking for Amsterdams in the United States. One of them is in Ohio, and they visited here, and they visited us today. Thanks again. That's about all the time we have for All Sides. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820, Columbus. We'll be back next time. Our every